Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
We might be chasing after figures and teachers who really are not meant for us, in the sense that they can't really touch the depths of our being. For me, for example, Jesus is a Western shaman, and Christ is a European bodhisattva. And he is the one given to post-Western society.
The Medicine Path podcast is an ongoing exploration into the intersections of spirituality, depth psychology, and psychedelics. The Medicine Path is a wholly independent and listener-supported project, so please consider becoming a supporter at patreon.com/medicinepath or by subscribing and leaving a review on iTunes. You can find out more information at medicinepathpodcast.com. Now, here's your host, Brian James.
Welcome to the Medicine Path Podcast. I'm your host, Brian James. On this episode, I speak to Professor Sean McGrath. Sean's resume includes time as a professed monk in a contemplative Catholic religious order and training at the Jung Institute in Zurich, both of which make him uniquely qualified to have a conversation on psychology and Christianity, or perhaps, to put it more accurately, the psychology of Christianity. Now, as some of you know, I've been gradually opening up more publicly about the unexpected encounters with Jesus Christ I had in the years I was working with ayahuasca in both the Santo Daime tradition and ceremonies of the Shipibo and Ashaninka lineages. Ever since those experiences, I've been quietly wrestling with my thoughts and feelings about Christianity, and it's a journey that's led me back to the roots of Western civilization and reconnected me to my recent ancestors, for whom Christianity was the central pillar of their personal and communal lives. As I meet writers and teachers like Sean and Mark Vernon, who I've found helpful in sorting out my feelings about Christianity, I'll try to get them on the podcast so that you can listen in on our conversations, because I know that I'm not alone in wondering what place Christianity, or more specifically, the Christ, has in our postmodern, psychologically informed lives. Now, if you've been finding these conversations helpful, I'd really like to hear about it. So please consider sending me an email at hello@brianjames.ca or give me a follow on Instagram at Revealing the Soul. Okay, that's all for now, so please sit back, relax, and enjoy this conversation with Dr. Sean McGrath on the Medicine Path. Okay, so a little background. I first heard you on a podcast called Psychology and the Cross. And I was really struck by some of the things you had to say, particularly about Jung, psychology, and Christianity. And it's an area that I've been exploring lately. And so I really wanted to have you on the podcast. And with the added bonus that you're a Canadian professor, which is great. I think we need more Canadian voices other than Jordan Peterson talking about psychology and Christianity and religion, those kind of things. So I wanted to give a platform for your voice because I think you have a unique voice and you speak with some authority based on your background. So maybe a great place for us to start is if you could offer a little bit of that background, your journey to becoming a professor of philosophy and theology.
Sure. I didn't go directly at it. I entered a religious order right after undergrad, a contemplative Catholic religious order living off-grid in Nova Scotia. And for 5 years, I was a monk and lived in the Middle Ages. And after 5 years, I went to graduate school. I left the order, went to graduate school, and did my graduate degrees in philosophy and theology. And that was about 7 years in Toronto and in Germany. Philosophy of religion, you know, medieval philosophy, sorting out the things that I had learned in the monastery and expanding them with my discovery of things that I didn't learn. For example, Protestantism, which interested me greatly and continues to. And then after that, when I was a newbie in the university world, I began to teach Jung because I had read Jung in the monastery to sort out my life. There are some rough waters, as there always is in a novitiate, and Jung was an immense help to me. And so once I entered, you know, once I got into position to go more deeply into it, I did. I started by teaching it, and then I began proposing research projects in it. And the research project led to immersion. So I entered the C.G. Jung Institute as a training candidate, and I was there 4 years. I got halfway through their program. I did their so-called propedeuticum. And got out before finishing the practicum because I realized that my calling was to be a professor and not a therapist. And I'd done what I needed to do there.
Now, was reading Jung, that something to do with you leaving the monastery?
In some ways. It had more to do with me sorting out, you know, my sexuality, I was 23 years old and I was living a celibate contemplative life and fell in love and couldn't understand how my religious commitments could be so upended by a young woman. You know, I was completely out of my mind and I didn't know what was going on. So it was actually the Jungian teaching on love and the relations between the sexes and the animal-animus matrix that really opened my eyes. So I didn't actually intend to leave because of Jung. It was more, I found a way to stay. What really drove me out was a desire to do more scholarly work. And that wasn't our calling. We were called to a very simple contemplative life following the Carmelite tradition. Most of my life would have been manual labor. I would have had a couple hours, maybe a day for intellectual work, but I wanted to go more deeply into everything. I had lots of questions. I was getting up early in the morning and instead of reading John of the Cross, I was reading existential philosophy, things like that. And so I just had to follow this, you know, book. A vocation comes from within and something was driving me into scholarship. And that was the main reason to leave. But I never really left. I'm still a monk in many ways. I'm a married man, I have a son. But what I learned then, my contemplative life, the contemplative practice I learned, and my appreciation for contemplative Christianity has never diminished, not at all. It's only enriched.
Yeah, well, it's been interesting as we've been corresponding to set this up. You keep sending me messages from, you know, I just got back from the woods. I was out in a canoe for 4 days. And so very much like a kind of pastoral monkish life, if it is one, like communing with nature, like St. Francis or something. That's how I imagine you out there in the wilds of Newfoundland.
Well, I'm 55. So I've been at this academic gig for quite a while. And I'm beginning to think that there's another life after this. and I might just find myself I don't know, spending much more time out in the woods in the years to come. That would suit me well.
I've been, as I've been wrestling with my own Christianity past couple of years, I'll go to a church and like, just give it a go, see if I'm a good fit for it or if it's a good fit for me. And not having found a home in any church so far, the idea of a new Christianity that is like, you know, two or three gathering in some natural place to break some bread, maybe share some wine and some discussion around a fire sounds the most appealing to me. And I wonder if maybe that's something you could get going out there.
Absolutely. In fact, it wouldn't be the first time Mass was said on the deck of my off-grid cabin for a couple people. So come on out.
We'll arrange something. You're already doing it. That's great. Okay. So I think maybe you've answered this already, but one of my first questions was, I've heard you say that you're specifically a Christian theologian, but I was wondering if you consider yourself a Christian. And I think the answer is yes, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
A contemplative Christian. Yeah. Multi-confessional. At home in I'm Catholic by training and birth. My psyche is Catholic. That's how the Catholics do it. They get you when you're a baby and they shape your mind. So, in terms of my theology, probably more inclined towards Protestantism and certainly fascinated by all things ancient Greek. So Eastern Orthodoxy is also of interest to me. So I consider myself to be sort of a Christian who's in alignment with anyone who regards the Council of Nicaea and Chalcedon as determinative of Christianity, whether pro or contra. But anyone who finds those basic ancient councils in which the doctrine of the incarnation and the doctrines of the Trinity and were defined, and for any group for whom those are somehow foundational, I'm more or less aligned with them.
When you say contemplative Christianity, is that something specific? Because I mean, my kind of contact with that is through maybe someone like Richard Rohr or Cynthia Bourgeau, who I think are quite different, but maybe both could be considered contemplative Christians. But I haven't been able to find anything resembling a clear defined practice that would define one as a contemplative Christian. I mean, it just seems to me like a umbrella term. I'm not sure what it actually means.
Yeah, it's a good point. I think what's happened is that there's been a great decline in contemplative Christianity and generally in contemplative culture in the West and in European and post-European societies. A great, great decline, not only in Christianity, but also in other dimensions of life, whether it's rural life or just we've just fallen very far. So Richard Rohr, for example, has gone very far in resisting that decline, and he's made the term at least somewhat mainstream. What Rohr teaches is essentially what the contemplative Christians all through the ages have taught. So Rohr is not doing anything particularly innovative. And contemplative Christians know that contemplative Christianity is not a version of Christianity or a marginal thing or a revision. It's actually the central piece.
Or an alternative to
it's not
the
an alternative. Yeah.
Institutional churches.
It isn't an alternative. It runs right through the institutions all the way back. So it depends on how much we know about history, but you know, the New Testament, for example, the letters of St. Paul or the letters of John and the Gospel of John, these really cannot be understood in any other way than as writings of contemplative religion, or if you want mystical, that's the heart of the gospel. Now, that's not widely recognized, but that remains the case. And people like Thomas Merton spent their life trying to remind people of that. And it's just continually being forgotten. So I consider myself as lending my small efforts to the task of remembering the contemplative mystical heart of the Christian gospel. And that allows us to put the gospel into alignment with things that many people know much more about, for example, Mahayana Buddhism or Zen Buddhism, or even shamanism, if you want. We can find all kinds of interesting ways in which the gospel can be understood and reanimated and reactualized through these non-Christian and non-Western lenses. There is no question in my mind that the forgetting of the mystical contemplative core of Christianity is one of the great failures of the West, and it's at the heart of many other problems, including ecology, economy, and so on.
I suppose I wasn't aware of it until you started talking about it, but I think maybe I had some conception of contemplative Christianity as being a version of Christianity that was trying to be ecumenical, that was importing meditation practices from the East, Christianizing them in some way, so that a contemplative Christian would have a practice of, say, prayer of the heart or something like that. But the picture that's forming in my mind as you speak is that contemplation is maybe best understood as someone who is wrestling with ideas about religion and personal relationship with Christ or God, that it sounds like it's more of an internal working out of things. So it sounds to me like quite active and engaged.
Well, there's certainly, you know, there's practices, there's techniques, but it's much less technique oriented than some forms of Buddhism. But there's also forms of Buddhism that are far less technique oriented, and there's some interesting parallels there. You know, you mentioned the Jesus prayer, the Hesychast tradition. There's an excellent example of a Christian contemplative practice. But there are other things. And the Benedictine monasticism is a kind of placeholder for many of these practices. So the practice of Lectio Divina, which is something extremely important to me, which means you start your day reading, but you read in a different way. You're reading meditatively. You're reading in a... Typically, it was scripture, and it often is for me, but it can be anything, so long as the reading is not for the sake of distraction or information or scholarly work or something like that, but it's actually for nourishing and inspiring you so that you can hear the voice of God through the sacred texts. So there are other practices as well. Certainly the Mass and the liturgy, you know, the liturgy is a poetic text that has been composed by countless writers over the course of 2000 years. Many of these prayers are very ancient, and they put us in alignment with Byzantium, with ancient Greece, with Alexandria, with lost places and lost figures and lost philosophers and theologians, who were all, in one way or another, they were all mystics and contemplatives. And these prayers were intended to bring about an experience of intimacy with the Christ. Not to raise yourself up above humanity, because you don't need to do that, because the Christ has actually entered into humanity, which means there's no need for a technique to transcend your human being. There's really rather just a practice of reception and openness and recognizing that there's another power moving through you and moving through history. And once you begin to trust in this power and less on yourself, you begin to see that the scriptures are actually accounts of human experiences of Christ nature.
I know much more about yoga than I do Christianity. I'm trying to get caught up on the Christianity thing in order to reckon with my own kind of ancestral lineage, let's say. And my own personal experiences, which have been surprising and confounding to me as someone who wasn't seeking Christ. but I'm seeing a lot of parallels actually with the path in yoga called Kriya Yoga, which would be the yoga of action. And I think about Richard Rohr's Center for Action and Contemplation. Kriya, action, interesting. Mm-hmm. But the three pillars of that practice is tapas, vajaya, and ishvara pranidhana. Tapas is like asceticism, so fasting or moderation in food, but would also include something like a mantra repetition. Svadhyaya is what you're talking about with reading the spiritual texts and using that as a way of self-reflection and intimacy with the divine. Ishvara Pranidhana is, like a surrender to that. It sounds like contemplative Christianity has very similar parallels in terms of practice.
Well, I think when you want to find the unity of religion, you need to look at the contemplative side of every religion. And, you know, not all of Hinduism is contemplative. Not all Hindus are yogis. So, and it's true. It's also the case with Buddhists and Taoists, and Confucianists. Mm-hmm. But when you go into the contemplative traditions of each of these, and by contemplation, we really simply mean an experiential account, or an account of experience, of religious experience. Religion not as a matter of propositions primarily, but as a matter of experience and of an experience of transformation and transcendence. And then we're very much on some pretty common ground where we can start to read, you know, Dogen from medieval Japan or Shankara from medieval India. And you can, we begin to see that actually, although these are not the same thing, and these discourses should not be collapsed into each other, mm-hmm. but there is a kind of common human gathering around the mystery, you could say, of the origin and the destiny of human being, which includes us and includes you and me as the finite persons that we are. So I think the contemplative Christian thing is very simple, and it's so simple, that's why we keep missing it. Any Christian who has an active prayer life is a contemplative Christian. There are many Christians who don't have an active prayer life. That is, for them, Christianity is a matter of morals or family tradition or, you know, the right thing to do. But any Christian for whom prayer and the interior life plays a role is a contemplative. So if you go to a Catholic church on a weekday mass, you know, 8 a.m. or whatever, you'll find people there who are praying. You don't necessarily see so many of them on Sunday. Maybe older people, who knows who they are, someone who's perhaps finding, maybe somebody who just likes the quiet space of the church. Let's not forget that these churches are some of the last refuges in cities where there's no commerce, you know. The church is a public space. It's a place without, it's a non-capitalized space. It's a place for prayer. And previously the doors were always open. That's less and less the case now. But European cities, for example, I've had wonderful times wandering around Paris or Rome or Florence and just nipping into a small medieval church in the middle of a hot day and just sitting in the cool silence with the great ancient stones around me and the symbols of the tradition pouring down on me through the stained glass window and entering into a state of prayer. It's a very common thing. And anyone for whom Christianity is a serious thing will know that. Now, I spoke about church, and it's not, of course, essentially bound up with church. Churches have come and gone, and they look different in the first century than they do now, and they're going to look different a century from now. So the church, you know, we shouldn't get fixated on buildings and structures and vestments and orders and so on. All these things are necessary in a certain way, but none of them are essential, if that makes any sense. There's always going to be something like that kind of structure, but it's going to change.
I'm not sure if there always will be something like those structures. Like, you know, the Catholic churches, or maybe, you know, some of the older Anglican churches that we have here on the islands, very Anglican here, but those are like kind of, like you said, an oasis in this sea of commerce and, you know, billboards shouting at you, everything That's vying right. for your attention, you know. I have some amazing memories of the experience that you're describing here when my wife and I lived for a couple of years in Montreal. And Montreal is one of the older Canadian cities, and it's, you know, there's a church on every corner, basically.
Yes.
And I used to love. I taught a corporate yoga class right in the financial district, business district in Montreal, downtown Montreal, which is just so busy and hub. But after the class, I would always go across the street to go sit in the Catholic church, and it was exactly like you described, the coolness, the quietude. And whenever I'd go into one of the little side rooms, I don't know what you call them, but be like a little smaller room with some
chapel,
pews, a little side chapel. But like you said, middle of the day, during the week, there'd always be people in there sitting quietly. It was beautiful. And there was no dogma.
European yoga. Yeah, that's European yoga.
I get it, man. I get it. And to think that that is going away, or that they're keeping the doors locked during the week, it's been difficult. Like, my wife and I moved here to Victoria right at the beginning of COVID. And, I was looking for churches to go check out, and most of them were closed down, not doing in-person masses and things like that. And everything was going to Zoom. And then it seems like even after the danger of the pandemic is subsiding, that out of convenience sake, like, people realize, oh, it's just so much more convenient to do things online.
Yes.
There's more resistance to going back to in-person, but we miss that essential experience.
And it's going to break out in other places. What I meant by saying necessary but not essential is that people will organize themselves somehow, and that's already happened. There's interesting movements happening, like urban monasticism. In big cities in the U.S., a community of people, families, deciding to actually live a common life in a certain way, in an apartment building or an apartment block, which means that they commit to one another in a certain way. They might even take vows and pool resources and help the weakest among them, and gather together for something like liturgy. And it might be a mass, it might be meditation, and a common meal. That kind of structure, I mean, it's so Jesus, that's so New Testament. That's what we read about in the New Testament. And this is the core, this is the very heart of liturgy. There's going to be some practice of common symbols. Symbols are very important, as you know, from the yoga tradition. Where would we be without them? And there's going to be a space of being together, which has a focus not on socializing necessarily, or on commerce or anything else, but on this common shared interior path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's happening in different places. And I think the environmental movement is constantly seeing little eruptions of something quasi-liturgical and contemplative, maybe focused on nature. But it's very hard for environmentalists to stay, hardcore natural scientific about ecology, because the values that are evoked and the commitment and the love for the beauty of the natural world and the moral indignation at what's happening to it, and the sense of reverence and awe for the world that we are so badly abusing, this brings people into the space of the religious.
Hmm. Yeah, and yet there's this, I don't know if it's growing or not, but we live in a kind of mostly secular culture now. I don't know if it's safe to say that. It seems quite secular. And in the ecology movement, what I see, people talking about, we need a new mythology to live by, one that is cosmological, that includes all the things you talked about, like the wonder and awe of nature and seeing the interconnectedness of all things. But we're not going to do it with any religious symbols or without any religious doctrine. It's going to be like kind of a secular eco-religion, maybe, mm-hmm. like Brian Swim or someone like that.
I know the figure, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that that's enough to get us through? Like, because then we don't, the only symbol is like that photo of the Earth from space. I mean?
No, we're symbolic animals, and we will find our symbols to gather around. Something will constellate itself. But the question of the secular is extremely interesting to me, and I've written a fair bit about it. But essentially, I don't believe that Christianity is opposed to secularism. I think Christianity is self-secularizing, and in some respects, Christianity is the origin of the secular. Not to say that the secularism we have now is correctly thematized or adequate to itself, but what is at the heart of the secular? It's the sense that the sacred and the distinction between the sacred and the profane, which is a perennial distinction as old as human beings, is no longer pertinent. That there really is no boundary anymore, and this can be played in two different ways. One, you could say now everything's profane. more or less the sacred is gone, God is dead, or you could play it the other way, which is the much more, you know, contemplative Christian, maybe Mahayana Buddhist way to play it, is that everything is sacred. Every task, every act.
Yeah. But the old saying goes, if everything's sacred, if there are no boundaries to the sacred, then actually nothing is then sacred because it's the boundaries that make the thing sacred. It's the distinctions, right?
There's definitely a logic to it. Yeah. But it's truly striking when you read the history of secularism, European secularism, to see how deeply motivated they were by Christian commitments. So, for example, the priesthood of all believers, that we don't need priests above us, mediating for us. Divinity, we have all become adequate to it through the Christ. Christ is the only thing we needed. Christ is the mediator. Christ is everywhere. And if you look at the inaugural moments in the life of Jesus, they are profoundly ordinary, everyday moments. You know, think of the great seven signs in the Gospel of John. The first one is turning water into wine at a wedding. At a party.
At a party.
and it continues. The Eucharist.
Jesus was a great host. How's that for a pun?
He was a great host. And he seems to have, the significance of the figure seems to have been to enter into each of these moments, these spaces of the profane, whether it's childbirth, marriage, friendship, work, and to render them capex dei, that the divine is there. It's kind of an invasion of divinity into the everyday. And it creates this crisis, as you say, this crisis where the sacred disappears and we suddenly become godless. But this can be easily turned around. And this is why the contemplative is so important, into the other insight, that actually everything is sacred. And there's no method needed. There's no technique. There's nowhere to go. And there's nothing to reach for, because it is a divine suffused existence that we are involved in. There's nowhere to go. And so my work, my love, my context, my community, all of that is enough. And that's very monastic practice. You know, monks live very ordinary lives. You know, it's just ordinary stuff becoming in some way theophanic, revelatory, through the practice of attention, through dignifying every ordinary act with a kind of reverence and attention that this too is of God. This too is the site of revelation. This is the place where Christ is right now, you know, in the workshop, at the computer.
You're sounding a lot like a non-dualist there when you say there's nowhere to go, there's nothing to do, it's all here.
I think Christianity is fundamentally non-dualist. I think there's a whole non-dualistic logic that runs through Christianity from the incarnation to the Trinity. It can only be understood non-dualistically.
Yeah, I hear you. And at the same time, I wonder then, because often what happens in the non-dualist, especially like Neo-Advaita, the way it's been interpreted in the West, like we kind of mess everything up when we import things. But then what happens is that there is no practice. There is no shared ritual. There are no symbols. And I don't know where that leaves us. It doesn't sound like a very enticing way to go for me, because I love all of those things. And ritual to me helps renew the engagement with the divine, like as the kind of remembrance, or at least something to share with others, so that we're not sitting around in hammocks going, well, there's nothing to do, isn't it wonderful? Yeah.
Well, non-dualism is the most difficult of all practices, and there's so many ways to go wrong with this. And the Indian tradition and the Buddhist tradition is full of fascinating discourses on this topic, but my understanding is that the highest form of non-duality is the non-duality of the non-dual and the dual. So the non-dualist who believes that the exclusion of so-called dualistic thinking, whether that's creator God or practices of or the distinction between delusion, enlightenment, whatever, this kind of exclusionary logic immediately betrays the practice. Right. So the non-dualist, by virtue of the logic of non-duality, has to come around to affirming a kind of everyday, a sense of two-ness, which is not two. So, you know, God and creation are not two, and they're not one. That is a true non-dual Christian insight.
Yeah, beautiful paradox.
We can't therefore say there's no God, there's just this here and now. This would be a kind of exclusion, which is intrinsically, I think, dualistic in the wrong sense. So I like to think of coming back to the symbols through a kind of non-dualistic detour, which breaks up our propositional attachments and our fixations on, you know, oh, we got to get somewhere. It's got to go. After death, I'm going to see Jesus. And, you know, I'm going to be enlightened after so many lifetimes. And if I just practice hard enough, and if I sit down and watch my breath and don't get distracted, all this kind of nonsense, you know, we have to kind of break that apart. And non-dualism is the negative moment we need. But I think there's something to be achieved on the other side of that, which is a return to the symbolic and now recognizing it for what it is. It becomes alive then, huh?
Yeah, I think that's so great. I think thinking of the event of the non-dual experience as a point in a kind of journey, and then there's the return coming back to dualism, having had that experience, being the softening of all the attachments and rigidity, and thinking about what's right and what's wrong in terms of forms, and coming back to that with a more relaxed attitude allows you to be more greatly renewed by the experience of ritual and symbol, and also just like enjoying it and appreciating the beauty of it for what it is rather. Yeah.
Lightness, right? One becomes lighthearted about this. You know, that this is not my salvation, this technique, this practice, this symbol system, all of this too should be negated in some respects, but it also has its place, you know? Mm-hmm. We're not always in the space of ecstasy. And when we're not, we need those symbols.
Right. Yeah, the reminders, right.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Now, that experience of like the revelation of oneness, I've heard you talk about grace before, and grace has been a concept I've been wrestling with and really trying to understand from the Christian perspective and trying to kind of parse it with my understanding from Eastern perspectives. But could you talk a little bit about grace? Like, if we don't do a practice, can we ever have that moment of enlightenment, of revelation? Don't we have to be doing something? Or do we sit around and go, okay, it's all good, I just have to wait for grace? Like, do we have to somehow invite grace, or to like raise our hand in the astral plane and say, hey, I need a little help here?
Yeah, grace is like non-dualism. It's one of those tricky things that can be so badly misinterpreted and has been, you know, some kind of intervention, you know, like God shoots us a ray of help every now and then because we're screwing up or something.
Yeah.
That's not at all Paul's sense of grace. He's the first to use the term. Grace is, as the Eastern Orthodox discuss it, it's the energies of the Godhead pervading creation. So it's the presence of God in everything. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's inescapable. It's always victorious. It can only be defeated by one thing. That is the one who refuses it, and to refuse grace is to say, I can do this on my own. So it's what Shinran calls, you know, self-power. Self-power is the only thing that can, the only obstacle, and even that's not an obstacle because grace will come around. correct you anywhere. You'll fall on your face and discover that actually you can't do it on your own. So grace is really the other power that is carrying us. And you could call it the super conscious, if you like. You know, if we want to talk in a psychoanalytical register, it's certainly something that's outside of consciousness. It's non-egoic. So when we feel ourselves rescued by something, a dream, by a revelation, a conversion experience, even just a birth of a new sense of ourself, something that comes from outside what we think we are, that's what Paul means by grace. And Paul's message is that this grace is, as I said, everywhere and always victorious. And if you're and it becomes a way of avoiding the improper approach to the symbolic life, because one must always remember that these techniques, these symbols, these practices, these efforts you're making, they're really totally inadequate to the end. You're never going to perfect yourself. You're not going to divinize yourself, and you don't have to. It's already been done. So that they become more like practices of remembering then when we can make that detour. The symbolic life, the propositional practices, whatever, the techniques, the practices of recalling and remembering that, hey, it's already been done. We've got to avoid what Bonhoeffer calls the cheap grace and the cost of discipleship. I mean, yeah, there's a way in which, and Paul was dealing with this too. Paul's in Galatians, Paul is dealing with a group of people who think, oh, we can do whatever we want. Christ has redeemed us, redeemed the world, and we are destined for life, immortal life, and now we can sin.
Right. This is like what happens to some non-dualists when they take it up in a kind of naive way or something.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what this is exactly the point, I think.
Get out of jail free card.
Yeah. No. The point is that you've got to keep completely vigilant. So it's this paradoxical, constant vigilance, but never forgetting that everything depends on you remembering that nothing depends on you. And I think this is what the practices do. They constantly bring, often through our failure to do them very well, they bring it to bring it back to mind that actually nothing depends on me. And if it did, I'm doomed.
Right. Yeah, my striving is futile. Puts me in my right place. Yeah. I mean, I'm seeing so much like in particularly the yoga of Patanjali. He says very much exactly what you said. The moment you think you've got it is the moment to be most vigilant. And I mean, that's very psychologically astute too. I think Jung would pick up on that and say, he's onto something there, you know? And also this idea of the Ishvara Pranidhana of surrendering, ultimately recognizing that you're not in control of any outcome. So it's a stance of humility, you know?
And it has to be renewed every hour because we're in the grip of an egomaniacism that doesn't go away. And that's what Paul calls sin. It doesn't go away. It's just constantly there. So one then gets to the point of saying, well, I'm simultaneously sinner and saved, as Luther puts it. There's another fabulous non-dual moment in the Christian tradition. Simultaneously sinner and saved. My salvation is not incompatible with my being a miserable sinner. These are not two, you know. So,
I have to be the miserable sinner in order to be saved.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, yeah.
And the salvation actually is the experience of salvation is the illumination of your sinfulness. This is something that's very interesting: is the keen sense of sinfulness and failure that the saints have. And I've noticed this in accounts of other, particularly of Buddhist traditions. I'm thinking of Shinran, whose current fascination of mine, you know, this keen sense of their inadequacy and their incapacity on their own by their efforts to make themselves better. That seems to be simultaneous with the experience of grace. And psychologically, accepting this kind of moral impotence and finitude is absolutely essential in the contemplative life. One can't go very far without it.
Mm. Yeah, it reminds me of what Jung said. He said, I'll paraphrase, but I'd rather be whole than try to be good.
Yeah.
Something like that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the shadow, Jung would talk about the shadow, and, you know, our egos have this shadow, this disavowed other side to them, which we project onto others. And how do you get to know, how do you come to know who your shadow is? Well, you find out what it is that really bugs you. What it is, who are the people that annoy you? What do you find repellent? What repels you? What gets your ire up, you know? And there, invariably, Jung will say, we find disowned aspects of ourselves projected onto others. Maybe there's something there in the other person that elicits the projection, but the emotion, the attachment, the negative attachment, you know, the aversion, the hate, this is an experience of a disavowed shadow. And the acceptance of it is not permission. It's not like, oh, now I'll just be my worst self, but rather a humiliation. So mm-hmm. I think that Jung's doctrine of individuation is spot on with the mainstream contemplative traditions.
Mm. Yeah, and maybe what the shadow aspect that it's highlighting for you in your judgment of others is actually some sort of kind of moralistic complex, some kind of purity or judgmental complex that you've got going on.
That's right. And so suddenly the people that really bug you are the greatest gifts in your life, because only they can hold up the mirror. They're the only ones who will let you know what aspects of yourself you need to come to terms with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, speaking of Jung, a friend of mine a little while ago, he's kind of a new psychotherapist. And I think he's still trying to figure out like what kind of therapist he's going to be. And so we talk about people like Jung and Hillman, and folks like that quite a bit. He said to me, called me up one day, and he said, you know what? Jung is my religion. Like, he like found it. Mm. And my immediate reaction was like, whoa, like slow down. And it kind of like shocked me to hear that. But then later, you know, it's like, once you hear something, you see it everywhere, or you start to hear it everywhere. And I realized that this is, I think, an idea that's going around, is that Jungian psychology can be a replacement for religion, because people are like rejecting particularly Christianity or whatever religion they inherited. But this is like, oh, well, Jungian psychology or archetypal psychology in particular can give you everything that you get from religion, and without all of like the kind of the dogma and belief and all that stuff. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I think you've certainly named something that's pervasive, and Jungians in particular are the source of this. By Jungians, I mean, you know, trained analysts and who have, for whatever reason, found everything in their psychoanalytical practice. Jung himself is a little bit more subtle than that, and typically pulls back from saying, I'm offering a substitute for religion. What he actually says is, I'm offering something for people who, for whatever reason, have no religion. And he specified Protestantism, mm-hmm. because he thought Catholics, you know, they've got everything they need. They've got the devil, they've got Mary, they've got the crucified Savior, and they've got redemption and the priest and the mass and the whole symbolic.
Confession.
Yeah. They don't need psychotherapy. So right. His candidate for psychotherapy was a sort of what would we call a lapsed Protestant, you know, a Protestant who no longer goes to church and just regards it as some kind of
like himself
practice. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Because Jung actually saw that there was something about European modernity, which was, which needed this kind of treatment because of this is related to the secular, the moment of demythologization, the disenchantment of the world, the commodification of everything, the hegemony of technology, the reduction of everything to quantity. Jung was very keenly sensitive to this as a massive psychological shift, at least in one portion of humanity. He didn't assume that everybody was going through this. But he certainly saw that this is what was happening to, let's say, Protestant Christendom, and that this was a crisis, and that because the mythic life, the symbolic life, which is a better term, mythic, you know, I prefer to talk about the symbolic life. We need a symbolic life, and we need a symbolic life that's actually adequate to the fullness of our beings. So the transcendent needs to be somehow represented for us, however inadequately. And if it isn't, you know, curious and even pathological things will happen. So he was addressing that problem. And then I guess it's somehow ironic that the upshot of it is that he suddenly becomes a new form of religion, which it just doesn't work. It's just not complete enough. It's too shot through with scientism. And there's a kind of hubris to it too, to say that the psychoanalysis has now kind of lifted us above the human religion, which is as old as humanity, at least 200,000 years old. Now we have a better perspective. So we look down at all this. That's just rationalism, right? It's just an elevated form of rationalism.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. I never quite thought of it that way, but it does seem hubristic, because what belief in psychology, what it allows us to do is to kind of understand and deal with all the problematic aspects of life. Like, all the questions can kind of be answered according to your own preferences in a way, because psychology, there is no doctrine. You can just kind of like pick and choose, you know, whatever mythological figures appeal to you, whatever Greek gods and goddesses appeal to you, you just kind of like choose your own pantheon kind of thing.
And it serves that narcissistic, egocentric sin we were talking about, which is the one thing.
Because there's no surrender.
That's right. It's the one thing that can stand between us and grace or Buddha nature, is that sense that actually I'm in charge. And this is what disturbs me most about that Jungian psychology.
Yeah. Like, I'm in charge of my individuation process. Yeah. My analyst is like my priest substitute. I go do confession with them. I read Jung as, you know, reading of the scriptures kind of thing. But the piece of it that's lacking is the surrender to something greater.
That's right.
You know, someone might say, well, the big ass self, I surrendered to psyche, I follow psyche or something. But I don't know. It still sounds contained in the individual to me.
I mean, it's interesting to note how Jung had a great deal of trouble with that moment of surrender.
That great story, almost like a parable of him not being able to touch his head to the ground.
Yes.
Following his father's full surrender, right? Protestantism.
Yeah.
Protestantism. Yes, I've never said that.
When Jung speaks personally about religion, he always pulls back and says, "I'm a scientist. I don't believe." He might say, "I don't believe I know," or he'll say, "I'm actually just speaking about facts. I'm doing science, whatever." And his real faith is in science. I mean, it's very strange to say, because Jung is not regarded as the most rationally rigorous of thinkers, but he's got as much faith in science as does Freud. And this is a limitation, especially if we want to take him as a guide in matters that go beyond, let's say, psychotherapy. And there's a lot more to life than psychotherapy.
I hope so. Yeah, like Hilma would say, like two people talking about their problems in a windowless room as like the ship is sinking, you know?
Yeah.
I guess, you know, what that kind of makes me think about is, you know, that idea that Jung had, and, you know, when things are encapsulated like this, it never captures the full context of how he talked about things, which is, I think, one of the problems with kind of dipping into Jung. A lot of his stuff is taken out of context and so then therefore misinterpreted. But one thing that he did talk about was how religion acted as a kind of buffer between us and the direct experience with the numinous or with God, right? Mm-hmm. So all the rituals and dogma were actually a kind of protection from us getting completely overwhelmed by that experience. Mm-hmm. And following like what we've been talking about, I think if we flip that around, that the psychology itself can be a kind of protection or defense against the numinous experience in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. do you see that? Is it?
I certainly, in the sense that we, you know, it leaves the ego master of its house, or the self, which is just, you know, one wonders.
It's the inflated ego.
Yeah. That said, you know, I mean, these are difficult matters. I like very much what you said about the context. You know, Jung's movement was a living practice. He was someone who was enmeshed in a community of thinkers and disciples, of course, and students. But it was it was something that was really alive. And all of his writings were occasional writings, responses to something. You know, someone would ask him, "Oh, give us a paper on Mercurius."
Yeah. And he's very reactive.
Yeah, he's not at all like Freud in that regard. But Freud would, after 8 hours of practicing analysis, he would write all evening trying to master a kind of systematic overview of the metapsychology. And Freud is a credible writer and systematician. Jung was not like this. And his editors actually recognized that, his English editors. And they did something really strange. They said, well, what we'll do is we'll put the systematic structure onto these occasional fragmentary writings so that we can show that he's every bit as systematic and rigorous a thinker as Freud's. So you get the collected works of Jung, which read like, you know, some kind of system. But that's and many, many pieces were left out. So there's a scholarly reconstruction of Jung happening right now, which is quite exciting. And apparently there's what was left out exceeds greatly what was included in the collected works. Even the fact that the collected works are not even put together chronologically, actually, just indicates something peculiar happening here. You know, so you have a volume, Psychology and Religion, and it's pieces taken from all these different periods and contexts.
So it does seem to be like someone's journal entries kind of all pasted together. Yeah. Like he's very stream of consciousness when he writes.
He is, and he's full of genius and he's full of insight, and he belongs to our time in a very special way. And for that reason, I'm not done with him.
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever be done with him. He's too complicated and intriguing. Like he keeps drawing me back. Like even James Hillman, I find the same way. At some point, I just get so fed up with him that I put him away for a while. But then I find myself being like kind of lured back by some of his ideas.
Right. Well, for me, Jung is one of Jung's most important roles is that he maintains this link with the 19th century, the rich history of 19th century romantic psychiatry, and behind that, the whole history of European modernity from the Renaissance onward. You know, Jung keeps that alive. That's Jung's context. But Freud was deliberately shutting that down and replacing it with something that he thought was more rigorously scientific, his model of the psyche, which is emphatically not religious. Jung was a conservative movement to say, on the contrary, there's a lot of psychoanalysis in 19th century German philosophy, for example, and German romanticism. The unconscious is a concept that's richly articulated and defined 100 years before Freud writes a single word. So Jung is maintaining that. You know, we look at his collective unconscious theory, we think it's some kind of innovation. Every theory of the unconscious prior to Freud was the theory of the collective unconscious. Every single one that I know of. Freud was unique in personalizing and reducing the unconscious to the life of an individual. So what Jung was doing was giving his vote of allegiance to the tradition against Freud.
Yeah. I think you highlight something that I found to be true is that Jung is like an incredible guide to the whole history of Western culture and its development and changes of consciousness within it. Like everything's in there. Like he's willing to wrestle with the religious problem, like post Nietzsche, like God is dead. Okay, well, what are we going to do about that? And what are the implications of that? And then reporting on the ground, you know, during the world wars and post-war and kind of seeing into the future where it's all leading. I mean, incredible, like the scope of his thinking. The only person that I think comes even close is someone like Rudolf Steiner.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good comparison. They were contemporaries, although they had nothing to do with each other.
I know. Like, look, they had to have met or been thinking about each other, but I haven't been find any evidence that there's been any interaction. But I can't believe that. Like, were their ethos just too great that they were like, "I'm staying away from that guy"?
Yes.
Yeah.
And their movements were in competition.
Yeah.
It was not ignorance of each other. It was actually avoidance of each other. But you know what you say makes me think that the person whose only religious guide in life is Jung is really not doing that badly, because through Jung you can find your way into everything. And if Jung is their gateway into the history of the West, you know, right back to, you know, ancient Gnosticism,
yeah.
Well, that's not so bad.
You know? Yeah. But I think the thing is, you have to go all the way with him. Like when he said, "You don't understand anything about my psychology until you've read the Bible."
Yeah.
So how many of those people following Jung are going past reading the black books or the red book or whatever and getting kind of enthralled with these images and this story of this guy going through this journey to the unconscious of and actually going back and reading the Bible, reading, you know, the Gnostic stuff or whatever, like going back to the source text, which I think Jung would say, look, you have to go back to the source. You can't just get it all through me.
They read the answer to Job, but they don't read the book of Job.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm. Or they listen to Jordan Peterson talk about Jung's answer to Job. you know, it's like three steps removed now.
Oh yeah. But we're in a time of great illiteracy and great decline. And I think one of the things we're touching on here is how rich and nuanced and complex European intellectual life was in the middle of the 20th century compared to what we're dealing with now. The soundbite culture. And it's something that can't be avoided. It's too big. It has to do with technology and media. On the one hand, it's wonderful. There's so much information and there's so many ways in which one can constitute a community for themselves and cultivate their interests. But on the other hand, there is a kind of degeneration of common literacy. And I think that this is why I think, you know, Jung is not the worst thing in the world.
Yeah, no, that's true, because he does, in a way, help to curate your education.
That's it.
I've been studying with Thomas More, who you have maybe some things in common with, actually. You know, he was a monastic for an early part of his life and got out of it. And but so I've been studying with him for a while now. And one of the things I appreciate most about it is that he's like someone that I trust as an elder, and he's doing basically what he's doing is curating an education for us. He's not delivering it so much as kind of like pointing to some very specific texts and people, say like, if you're interested in this, kind of check this stuff out. And what that does is put a lot of the burden of the education on me is to follow up on those leads and then, you know, enter down these cavernous rabbit holes, you know, like you point to like Hillman, all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, you're wrestling with Hillman one day, and then you're wrestling with, I don't know, Heraclitus or Epicurus the next day, you know. So it's a lifelong education, but it's so helpful to have someone give those pointers, you know, like people are on our tree if you're interested in this tree.
And what we're talking about generally, Hillman, Thomas More, to some degree, Peterson, certainly C.G. Jung, is the recovery of the spirituality of the West. And this is so important because we know so much about the East now. And many of us have been so transformed by our experiences with the East, with yoga, with Buddhism, and also with the North and the South, with shamanism. We are now all very religiously literate in a certain way. But the one thing that we don't know very much about is our own tradition. And there's a psychological problem there because we might be chasing after figures and teachers who really are not meant for us, in the sense that they can't really touch the depths of our being. For me, for example, you know, Jesus is a Western shaman and Christ is a European bodhisattva. And he is the one given to post-Western society.
All right.
There's a place of power there that I suspect well, it could have more effect on an individual's life than anything that you'll find elsewhere, if only because of the reality of our cultural heritage, of our collective unconscious, if you wish, which is localized in a certain way. We're not just all lost.
It's specific.
In the sea. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
No, that's so great.
I really appreciate Jung for doing this. And he said, this is my task. He traveled to India and he realized he had a dream, I think, of the Christ. And he realized my task actually is to not to recover a global religiosity, but actually to be the psychoanalyst of Western religion. Mm. And for that reason, because he saw the problem there, he saw the illness there.
Well, and being active in that time of the theosophists and the anthroposophists, he saw what all of that kind of cultural cherry picking, what that could lead to. Mm-hmm. You know, he must have known about Aleister Crowley too. You know, like
Crowley knew about him. Crowley wrote an interesting review of his first book. Really interesting review. Jung's first book was called "The Symbols of Transformation," and it's a very scholarly and peculiar book in which he offers an alternative reading of libido than Freud. And this is when Freud realized this guy can't be my follower, because Freudian libido was sexual and deviates from sexuality in perversions. But Jungian libido was sort of
life force,
amorphous. Yeah, it was life force. Yeah. It was just a direction towards any possible goal in some respects. And so Crowley picks up on this and he says, this guy, C.G. Jung, this is like in 1912, I think, a review. C.G. Jung has broken through this new science of psychoanalysis, which is probably pseudo, like most of the new things. He's broken through to the old magical idea of will. And he's absolutely right. Because that's that connection that I was talking about. Jung as the conservative who's retaining this link back to the Renaissance and deeper, of course, to a practice of transformation, of spirituality, which is European. Mm. And which might be the medicine we need.
Yeah. Just going back a step or two, I think you're absolutely right. Like, Christ is what we were given. There's something so specific about that. And what I've been thinking about lately, coming out of my own experience of this like encounter with the Christ, this unexpected encounter that forced me to wrestle with the whole Christian thing. What I've been thinking about is that Christianity is like in my genes. And I think in a lot of us moderns, it's like a latent potential, like epigenetics, you know, how other characteristics are passed on through the lineage, and they may be lying dormant until something comes along to activate it, like a cancer cell. Breast cancer is one example of how that gets carried on, but doesn't necessarily get activated in the person. But it's lying there as a potential. And for me, having this activated through exploration of yoga and plant medicine shamanism in South America, what it activated was not some kind of pagan belief in Mother Ayahuasca or Shakti in particular, but specifically this Christ figure or being or force. You know, I'm still trying to understand the relationship between Jesus Christ, the person, and what I've experienced is some kind of Christ power or Christ force that's in the world. Maybe starting to get hints that maybe what I've been trying to think of is what they call the word or logos.
That's right.
Really hard to define thing. Like Peterson, I think, just reduces it too much to something like order. But what I've been thinking about it more of as following maybe in John, it's like almost like a Shakti. Like it's the creative force in the universe. That everything in creation has come through this.
That's right. All through him, all things were made. Well, what this question is the question of Christianity. So those councils that I talked about, Nicaea, Chalcedon, this was their question as well. What is the relationship of the Logos to the to Jesus, to the man? So it's the very heart of the whole thing. But it touches on something that I wanted to share with you, because I was thinking a lot about this in anticipation of this discussion. Let me just have a look at what I wrote here. Yeah, Christ in Paul and John is a cosmic power before it is a savior, Messiah. It's the one word of the Father. So the image of the invisible God through whom all things are created. That's a quote from Colossians. Or it's the light of all people, John says. Another quote from the first letter of John, the true light which enlightens everyone, or the word of life. And the Christian Platonists called it the form of forms. The Logos was sort of like this, the form of forms. Everything in the world is patterned off a form, and all these forms are patterned off one form. So it's as how God speaks one word, and the word is his son, and in this one word, all things are spoken. That is the Orthodox tradition of Christology. And then the question of who Jesus is in relationship to the Christ is that's the big dispute that animates the whole thing and moves it forward right into today. But I mean, one of the things that's clear is that if Christ is the Logos, he's not a god. He's not like Zeus or Cernunnos or Mercurius or Hermes. These are creatures, these are forms. He's the form of all forms. So he's we could speak of Christ nature. I'm thinking about this as kind of riff on Buddha nature, because I love the concept of Buddha nature. Christ nature, much closer to Logos than this personalization of Christ as a god like Zeus or something, or Hermes, right? They're all finite. And now, of course, there is an essential relationship to the man Jesus, but they're not identical.
Yeah, well, the Christ nature idea, I mean, I think something like that was picked up by people like Yogananda, who was a yogi, came to the West, recognized that he was dealing with the Christian culture, and so incorporated Christianity into his yoga. And so he would talk about Christ consciousness.
Yes, that's close, yeah. Yeah.
But what does that mean? Does that mean like when I'm full of Christ consciousness, I'm just full of love and compassion for all beings? I think the Christ as the power is much more than that.
Certainly is. I mean, the identification with consciousness causes me to kind of take a step back because...
Well, the light in all things.
Yeah, the light in all things. The light and the life.
Right.
What does this Christ nature do? We could ask ourselves that. What does the Logos do? Well, it brings things together. It is the power of love and transformation. It brings knowledge. It brings freedom. It brings life. It brings life and it evolves.
Well, it brings everything.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, keep going, yes. Right?
Yeah.
Does it bring suffering too?
In a certain way, it's deeply bound up with suffering, isn't it? Because the Christ nature incarnates amongst us. And what does he do but suffer? Mm-hmm. Almost as the entrance of the Christ nature into appearance, into full manifestation, can only mean crucifixion.
Was that something like a kind of a birth pain, though? Like his suffering was necessary in the beginning so that we didn't have to suffer so much. And it's only our distance from Christ nature that causes our suffering.
Certainly, but yeah, I mean,
suffering can't be compared to his,
We have to get, we have to get technical and metaphysical, just as the Buddhists and the Hindus have to when they're talking about these great mysteries, right? So we have to talk about sin. We have to talk about the fallen world. We have to talk about a world that is opposed to the good. And this is a thought that's somewhat difficult for more monistically inclined thinkers. But we have to think of evil as real, as something that is actively pursuing our destruction. And the Christ nature overcomes this. This is the cosmic battle that Paul announces. The battle has been won. It's almost like there's a cosmic power battle happening, and it's been won for us. And now we no longer have to worry, and nothing can stand in the way of us and love. And with this kind of belief and trust in the overwhelming power of the Christ nature to vanquish death and the powers of death, with this trust in it, we become transformed. We become Christ men, Christ women. We become capable of things that we could never have achieved on our self power. Therein lies the whole story of Christianity. It's a story of saints and mystics understanding this fundamental point.
Yeah. I'm thinking now about how Jung wrestled with the idea of evil in Christianity and the notion of privatio boni, that that evil in itself doesn't have any substance, but evil is only the absence of the good.
Yeah.
And I know, like, he had a problem with that idea. He thought evil was a force in the universe. I tend to agree, but I don't think that those things have to be opposing to each other. So, like, if there's an absence of good, maybe that just leaves an opening for evil to enter and to maybe take over and influence through people and their actions.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, the whole debate around privatio boni. And one thing worth noting is that privatio boni is a Platonic concept and fully originates in a non-Christian context. So when Paul talks about it, this cosmic battle, he's not thinking about evil as a privation of goodness at all. But the other point, though, is that, and this is where privatio has something to offer us, is the complete disproportion between good and evil. So the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness doesn't even comprehend it. So we're not talking about, you know, this battle, this George Lucas battle between the good side and the dark side of the force. Evil seems to be something, some mystery that's permitted to occur for reasons that we do not understand, and that is bound up with our salvation and our transformation.
That's why it exists. Like, going back to what we were talking about before, the sin has to precede the salvation.
Right. That's right.
And the sin is what's the cause of sin? Well, evil, right? No.
So there's an ancient prayer that's sung at the Easter liturgy on Saturday called the Exultet. And it contains a theological error, something that's been regarded as a heresy, but it's sung in every Catholic church on Holy Saturday. And the line goes, "Oh, happy fault of Adam, oh necessary sin that earned for us so great a redeemer."
That's an error? That sounds right on to me.
Yeah, well, it's been recognized that, you know, we don't, sin is not necessary so that good should occur.
Oh, right. For people who subscribe to privatio boni.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, just like the line in the Lord's Prayer, right? Like, lead me not into temptation. That's right. Wait a minute. God is capable of leading us into temptation? Like, what does that say about God?
Right? Yeah, I just had a conversation with someone about that, with Don Carvath about it. I understand the point of that prayer to be, without God's support, which we always have, and we can always rely on, but were it not there, we'd fall immediately into temptation. Mm-hmm. In other words, the only thing that keeps us from falling to pieces and following the wrong spirit is the power of God. And so, in other words, it's a way of saying everything depends on you, and I recognize that.
Is that a good translation of the original? I'm guessing that it was probably Greek in its origin, or Latin?
I guess it would have been Aramaic. It's one of the Lord's Prayer is one of those.
That's in the book.
One of those pieces the biblical scholars will allow us to be probably in some form out of the mouth of Jesus himself. And so I'm not a scholar of Aramaic, so I won't say, but one can recognize the compatibility of the idea of temptation. Christ is, what's the first thing that happens when Jesus appears on the River Jordan, which is probably the first historical appearance, the nativity being something added after and constructed. Jesus's historical appearance is as a follower of John the Baptist gets baptized in the Jordan River. First thing that happens is there's a revelation and a voice from heaven says, "This is my beloved son." And then the beloved son is led into the desert where he is tempted by the devil. So there's a kind of immediate confrontation. immediate, you know, there's the evil one is where the holy one is. Not because mm-hmm. they're the same. They're not the same. But there's
but the holy one consolates the evil one. Yeah.
Yeah. They belong together. they're bound up with each other because the mystery of the existence of the evil one is bound up with this path of salvation. So he hates him. He hates him because he knows he shall be rendered a mere means to something greater than he can understand or than he could will. But he also knows that this is the, you know, this is the reason for his existence in a certain way. So the devil dogs the Christ right to the end.
This is like Jung's problem with the Trinity is that it left out the adversary, and he saw that just like the cross, that it shouldn't be a Trinity, it should be a quaternio, which he thought was the symbol of wholeness, that it goes something like Father at the top, Son, adversary, and then the opposites reconciled in the Holy Spirit. I think that's brilliant.
I think what's right about it is that a quaternity is a symbol of wholeness. But what's wrong about it is that is to assume Trinity is meant to be a symbol of wholeness, and also to assume that all these things are excluded. Because as you remember, it's not just the devil that's excluded, it's also Mary. It's Mary, it's matter, it's all this stuff. And the Trinity is the symbol of God in God's self. And there always is a fourth, which is creation. God and creation is the whole. The fourth is creation. And it's in creation that you find Mary and the devil, who's also a creature. He's a fallen angel. So he starts as a being produced by God, right?
Now, is that spelled out directly anywhere? Is this just kind of like something like a supposition?
This is my conclusion after wrestling with Jung on the Trinity for a long while, and reading the Trinitarian theologians and believing them for on logical grounds, really, rather than Jung, that the devil doesn't belong within the Godhead. The devil belongs within the whole, and the whole is a quaternity. But the devil it's not just the devil who's the fourth, it's creation, that which is other than God, which God allows to be. Why does God create? This is the great mystery. Does he need creation? This is a great debate. In any case, he wills that it should be, that there should be something other than himself. That constellates the fourth. The Trinity wills that there should be something other than itself. It constitutes the fourth, the other. And within this otherness, you know, all these other features that we're discussing appear, including, you know, femininity, passivity. We're not allowed to speak the way Jung spoke about women. But, you know, for him, that was an important thing.
The irrational and all that.
The irrational, the bodily, the material, the corrupting, the corrupt, the things that fall apart, you know, the blood, sweat, and tears.
That was just Gnosticism showing, I think.
I think so. I think that this is the crucial point where Orthodox Christianity, I do mean by that the ancient Christianity, has a better solution to the problem of wholeness and paternity, which is namely that Trinity plus creation is the whole.
Yeah, I mean, that itself lands really well for me, that the Trinity is not meant to be a symbol of wholeness. Yes, the quaternio is a symbol of wholeness, but the Trinity is not meant to be that and missing one of its limbs or something.
That's right. We have to be careful because we can't, I mean, this is a difficult issue, but what is the relationship of the Trinity to the fourth, to the other, to creation? Does it need creation to be whole? Are we saying that God is not whole? That's not what we're saying. The relationship of God to creation is a relation of freedom, a relationship of freedom. And for this reason, the fourth has this anarchic and chaotic quality to it, productive of things that God does not desire, but which he permits, such as evil.
Well, I think the image of the cross, that the fourth limb, the base of it, is stuck in the earth.
That's right. And often,
I mean,
it's all there.
Like, what's visible to us is really the three, the horizontal beam and the top, but the fourth is in the earth. Like, it's underneath your feet, kind of.
I think that's right.
Maybe.
The cross itself is a fourth. When, you know, there's an old theological principle that the work of any one persons of the Trinity is also the work of the others. So if the Son dies on the cross, well, in some respects, the Father and the Spirit are also there dying on the cross. So the Trinity is on the cross, but the cross is not part of the Trinity. The cross is the fourth, right? And the symbolism of that is so powerful. So that, you know, he becomes one of us. He becomes identical with a fallen and rebellious creation for the sake of overcoming darkness, death, and destruction. This is why if someone doesn't believe there is such a thing as evil active in the world, there's really very little way of bringing the gospel to them. And I don't know what to say other than, you know, they must read different news than me.
Amen.
And I think this is something of what Jung was in a very clumsy way getting at when he said the privatio tradition is diminishing the psychological reality of evil. And I think that was the case maybe in 50s scholastic Catholicism, maybe, I don't know. I don't think it is anymore.
Yeah. Again, I kind of reread some of those passages leading up to this conversation just to get refreshed on his position on these things. But again, I think it's one of those things that's been kind of reduced and distilled a little too much. When you get into him, like even the problem of Christ as an archetype, he didn't come out and really say that. You know, maybe Edinger kind of followed up and made that a little more concrete. But Jung was very much more ambivalent about Christ as an archetype. What he said is that people projected the archetype onto the Christ, you know, the archetype that was within them. Well, look, we could keep talking all day long. And I really appreciate your generosity in having this conversation with me and kind of going there with me. Maybe we could have another conversation down the road. I'm sure there's going to be more things I want to pick your brain about.
No, I very much appreciated the invitation, the opportunity. I mean, these are matters that are still deeply alive for me. So it's a pleasure and a joy to talk to you about them.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, your position too, you know, being, like 10 years older than me, but being steeped in this much longer, particularly the Christian tradition, I find like the way you put things together and also your understanding of the psychological and not discarding that is really helpful to me. It's helping me along my path and in my continual wrestling with this Christian thing. Still trying to figure it out, but you're helping me. So I'm sure you're helping other people too. One thing just to say that I know is going on out there, because as I've been producing podcasts and writing a bit more about my own journey with kind of my reckoning with Christianity, is that a lot of other people are going through it too. And maybe starting to come out of the closet in a way.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I'd like to know more about that. Yeah, I wouldn't surprise me at all if the next moment for Christianity comes completely from outside the institutional churches. That would surprise. That's what I expect.
That was in my notes actually, is to ask you your take on the kind of current trend of people converting to specifically Catholicism and Orthodoxy. Like a lot of people around our age, Gen Xers, who had maybe refused Christianity early on in favor of yoga, shamanism, eco-activism, you know, like Paul Kingsnorth. When they come back hard, and they kind of come back to the old institutions. And I'm like, I'm not so sure that that's the right move at this time. And what's kind of alive in me is like wondering, well, I feel like it's coming back, but it's got to find like a new form. Like, it's like the new, it needs to have the new wineskin, right? To use that analogy.
I think the institutions have spent themselves, and they're wonderful things, but they're monuments to the past. The spirit is, for the most part, not there, which isn't to say that there's no spirit in the world. It just means that it's moved as it has been moving for 2000 years or since the beginning.
Mm. Yeah. That's been my feeling too. The way I thought of it, I mean, I remember going to Grace Cathedral in San Francisco a number of years ago. Ironically, there I was there to teach yoga. And it was Easter Sunday, and I wanted to go to one of the great cathedrals in North America, right? And I remember going in, and, you know, amazing, just amazing place. I thought, this is a religious machine. From the stained glass to the incredible pipe organ, just the whole architecture of the place, it was like meant to produce a religious experience.
That's exactly right, yeah.
And this cathedral in particular, I found really interesting as a yogic person, because they had a labyrinth inlaid in the floor.
Amazing.
Mm. In like the main hall, like it was like central. But, and this to me was so illustrative of where the churches have kind of lost their way. Instead of having that labyrinth open to people to come in and walk around and contemplate, it had a bunch of folding chairs on top of it so that people could sit there and listen to the kind of pre-recorded liturgy or whatever, you know? And I was like, this is the whole problem. It's like, you've got this incredible religious machine and we've lost the user manual for it or something.
Well, that's the forgetting of contemplation we were talking about. You know, people would just be still and let the architecture and the symbols speak as they can, they still do. To say that it's of the past isn't to devalue it at all. You know, where would we be with our ancient temples? I'm sure you've been to a few. They stand for us as they're the ground of our present existence, and they still have a role to play, which isn't to say that they've never been able to, they don't confine the spirit. They never did. And it's interesting, I mean, another time we could talk about how Orthodox theology has always recognized that the spirit goes where it wants and that we don't have charge of it. Even the business of recognizing saints, you know, when the Pope recognizes a saint, what he does is he listens to see where the buzz is. Oh, there's a group of people making a big fuss about somebody over in Mexico. Oh, and looks like he's performing miracles, this guy. And then the Vatican goes to see, to recognize. So they don't define the saint. They recognize.
Well, because sometimes the people who are sainted could be kind of considered quite problematic for the church.
Many of them are very problematic and borderline and bizarre, you know. And so it's just one of many places. But we can't presume to be the author of this great mystery. And I think the church and its most sound theology has always recognized that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like what you said. The church doesn't contain it. Maybe the other part of that is it just kind of like brings to the forefront or intensifies the spirit in a way, or mm-hmm. outlines it in a particular way that, we can recognize it.
Yeah, it announces easily. It proclaims it, it blows right, a trumpet, builds a church, paints a picture, writes a symphony. But it's always response. It's not production.
Yeah, and not containment.
Yeah.
This has been so great. Sean, okay, here's final question. For someone like me, right? Explored Eastern religions, shamanism, things like that, kind of compelled to re-explore Christianity, or maybe it's the first time. So someone with a more contemplative or experiential, mystical inclination, who are some of the writers that you would point them to? You know, kind of classic writers, like well-established or well-revered.
Well, I wouldn't know anything about any of this if it wasn't for Thomas Merton. I think Thomas Merton is one of the most important Christian writers of the modern era. And he wrote a lot. Mm. So, and he's a wonderful writer. And he's an honest, honest writer. And he had his journey to the East, and he had his fall from grace and all of that. He's just, he was compelled to chronicle his whole religious life, which he did. His journals are extraordinary. His journals are the best part of his work. And there's, I don't know how many volumes of journals there are. So, I mean, it depends, you know, writing is so difficult. It depends on what people are looking for. Some people want arguments, you know. Merton doesn't give us arguments. There are other great figures, you know, G.K. Chesterton has some withering arguments against positivism and scientism that are extremely funny, and they can be really powerful for people. It depends on what somebody needs. If somebody needs their mind convinced, they go to a different author. But in terms of the contemplative Christian reawakening, I don't think you can go wrong with Merton.
Yeah, well, what speaks to me, and I think to a lot of the people who I know and I meet in the spiritual scene, seekers, is the confessional, is not coming from an authoritative position telling you how it is, but telling you more what it was like for me, and including the parts where they were wrestling or uncertain, or the falls from grace or the disillusionments. I think people want to be able to relate to some of these writers and thinkers in a very personal way.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Yeah.
Good.
There are a few others, but Merton... and when one sees his voice change, you know, he enters the strictest religious order in the world in the 40s, and he dies in Bangkok in 68 at a conference on Marxism, where he's on this journey to visit all the great Eastern sages, including the young Dalai Lama. And the transformation of his voice over that period is fascinating to watch. Yeah.
Okay.
He's only 53 when he died, so I've already outlived him.
So what's a good place to start with Merton?
Well, for you, I would pick up the Asian Journals of Thomas Merton.
All right.
So the order finally let him go, and he went and he traveled throughout India and Asia to some degree. Did he get to Japan? I don't think he did. Thinking about East-West and the meaning of these symbols. And his description of the experience of the Buddhas, the great stone Buddhas in Palinurua and Sri Lanka, yeah, just amazing. Just beautiful, beautiful writing. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
A pleasure. And thanks for reaching out, Brian. Enjoyed the chat very much.
Yeah. Hopefully we can do it again soon. Take care.
Take care.
The Medicine Path is produced by Brian James on unceded Coast Salish territory, Vancouver Island, Canada. For more information, visit brianjames.ca. Music by Olive Artizzoni, a.k.a. Greenhouse. Join the Medicine Path tribe and gain early access to episodes and the full podcast archives at patreon.com/medicinepath. May the road rise up to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face. May the rain fall soft upon your fields. Until the next time we meet, on the Medicine Path.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.